shoulder holster for from his previous life out there. The Browning X-444 has a 25-centimeter overall length, with a burl walnut handle and a brass butt cap, and a point Lentz had sharpened the clip out of when he got it and a single-edge Bowie-style blade with 0.1-millimeter serrations that Lentz owns a hone for and tests by dry-shaving a little patch of his tanned forearm, which he loves. The Browning X-444, combined with blocks of Don Gately's highly portable cornflake garnish meatloaf, were for canines, which your urban canines tended to be non-feral, and can be found within the confinement of their pet owners' fenced yards on a regular-er basis than the urban cat species, and who are less suspicious of food and, though more of a personal injury risk to approach, do not scratch the hand that feeds them. For when the dense square of meatloaf is taken out and unwrapped from the Ziploc and proffered from the edgelet of yard, out past the fence by the sidewalk, the dog at issue invariably stops with the barking and or lunging, and its nose flares, and it becomes totally uncynical and friendly, and comes to the end of its chain, or the fence Lentz stands behind, and makes interested noises, and, if Lentz holds the meat item just up out of reach, the dog, if its rope or chain will permit it, it'll go up on the hind legs and sort of play the fence with its front paws, jumping eagerly as Lentz dangles the meat. Day had had some recovery issue paperback he was reading that Lentz had a look at 1 p.m. in their room, when Day was downstairs with Ewell and her daddy, telling each other their win-bagathon stories, lying on Day's mattress with his shoes on, and trying to fart into the mattress as much as possible. Some line in the book had arrested Lentz's attention. Something about, the more basically powerless an individual feels, the more the likelihood for the propensity for violent acting out. And Lentz found the observation to be sound. The only serious challenge to using the Browning X-444 is that Lentz has to make sure to get around behind the dog before he cuts the dog's throat, because the bleeding is far-reaching in its intensity, and Lentz is now on his second Ralph Lauren topcoat and third pair of dark wool slacks. Then once, near Halloween, in an alley behind Blanchard's Liquors off Alston's Union Square, Lentz comes across a street drunk in a chewed-looking old topcoat in a deserted alley, taking a public leak against the side of a dumpster, and Lentz invisualizes the old guy both cut and on fire, and dancing, jaggedly, around, hitting at himself, while Lentz goes, there. But that's as close as Lentz comes to that kind of level of resolution. And it's maybe to his credit that he's a little off his psychic feed for a few days after that close call, and inactive with pets, circa 22-16 hours. Lentz has nothing much against his newer fellow resident Bruce Green. And when, one Sunday night after the white flag, Green asks can he walk along with Lentz on the walk back, after the Our Father, Lentz says whatever, and lets Green walk with him, and is inactive during this night's 22-16 interval as well. Except after a couple nights of Green strolling home along with him, first from the white flag and then from St. Columbkill's on Tuesday, and a double 1900 to 2200 shot of St. E's sharing and caring N.A. and then B.Y.P. on Wednesday, Green following him around like a terrier from meeting to meeting and then home, it begins to, like, emerge on Lentz that Bruce G. is starting to treat this walking through the urban PM with Randy Lentz thing as, like, a regular fucking thing. And Lentz starts to jones about it, the unresolved powerless rage issues, that the thing is, now he's gotten so, he's used to resolving them on a more or less nightly basis. So that being unable to be freely alone, to be active with the Browning X-444, or even a steel sack during the 22-16 to 22-26-hour interval, causes this pressure to build up, like almost a withdrawal-grade pressure. But, on the other side of the hand, walking with Green has its positive aspects as well, like that Green doesn't complain about lengthy detours to keep a mainly north-northeastern orientation to the walks, when possible. And Lentz enjoys a sympathetic and listening ear to have around. He has numerous aspects and experiences to mull over, and issues to organize and mull, and, like many people hardwired for organic stimulants, talking is sort of Lentz's way of thinking. But most of the ears of the other residents at Ennett House are not only unsympathetic, but are attached to great, gaping, flapping oral mouths, which keep horning into the conversation with the mouth's own opinions and issues and aspects. Most of the residents are the worst listeners Lentz has ever seen. Bruce Green, on the hand's positive side, hardly says anything. Bruce Green is quiet. The way certain stand-up type guys you want to have there with you, beside you if a beef starts going down, are quiet. Like, self-contained. Yet Green is not so quiet and unresponding that it's like with some silent people, where you start to wonder if he's listening with a sympathizing ear, or if he's really drifting around in his own self-oriented thoughts, and not even listening to Lentz, etc., treating Lentz like a radio you can tune in or out. Lentz has a keen antenna for people like this, and their stock is low on his personal exchange. Bruce Green inserts low affirmatives and no shits and fucking A's, etc., at just the right places to communicate his attentions to Lentz, which Lentz admires. So it's not like Lentz just wants to blow Green off and tell him to go peddle his papers and let him the fuck alone after meetings so he can go solo. It would have to be handled in a more diplomatic fashion. Plus, Lentz finds himself nervous at the prospect of offending Green. It's not like he's scared of Green in terms of physically. It's not like he's concerned Green would be the Yule or day type you have to stressfully worry about, maybe going and ratting out on Lentz's place of whereabouts to the finest, and everything like that. Green has a strong air of non-rat about him, which Lentz admires. So it's not like he's frightened to blow Green off. It's more like very tense and tightly wound. Plus, it agitates Lentz that he has the feeling that it really wouldn't be any big deal to Green that much one way or the other, and that Lentz feels like he's spending all this stress tensely worrying about his side of something that Green would barely think about for more than a couple seconds. And it enrages Lentz that he can know in his head that the tense worry about how to diplomatize Green into leaving him alone is unnecessary and a waste of time and tension, and yet still not able to stop worrying about it, which all only increases the sense of powerlessness that Lentz is impotent to resolve with his Browning and meatloaf, as long as Green continues to walk home with him. And the schizoid cats with clotted fur that lurk around Ennett House, cringing and neurotic and afraid of their own shadow, are too risky, for the female residents are always formulating attachments to them. And Pat M.'s golden retrievers would be tantamount to legal suicide. On a Saturday, circa 22-21 hours, Lentz found a miniature bird that had fallen out of some nest and was sitting, bald and pencil-necked, on the lawn of Unit Number 3, flapping ineffectually, and went in with Green, and ducked Green, and went back outside to Number 3's lawn, and put the thing in a pocket, and went in and put it down the garbage disposal in the kitchen sink of the kitchen, but still felt largely impotent and unresolved. Except for Pat Monacian's bay-windowed front office, and the house manager's phone booth-sized back office, and the two live-in staff bedrooms down in the basement, none of the doors inside Ennett House have locks, for predictable reasons. Early November, year of the Depend Adult Undergarment. The only bona fide, blackmailable thing about Rodney Tyne, Chief, U.S. Office of Unspecified Services, is special metric ruler. In a locked drawer of his bathroom cabinets at home, on Connecticut Avenue, northwest in the district, is kept a special metric ruler. And Tyne measures his penis every a.m., like clockwork, has since 12, still does. Plus, a special telescoping traveling model of the ruler he travels with, for on-the-road a.m. penis measurement. President Gentle has no national security agency as such. Tyne's in Metro Boston because of the national security implications of what they'd first come to unspecified services about two summers past, both the head of DEA and the chair of the Academy of Digital Arts and Sciences, now both here standing on one foot and then the other, and twiddling the brims of their hats. This unwatchable underground entertainment cartridge that, at first, seemed to be just popping haphazardly up in random locales. A film with certain, he's given to understand from briefings, quote, qualities, such that whoever saw it wanted nothing else ever in life but to see it again, and then again, and so on. It had popped up in Berkeley, NCA, in the home of a film scholar and his male companion, neither of whom had appeared for appointments for days, and now lost a meaningful human activity henceforward, by all appearances, were the scholar and companion, the two cops dispatched to the Berkeley home, the six cops dispatched after the two cops never followed up their code 5, the watch sergeant and partner dispatched after them, 17 police, paramedics, and telepeter technicians and all, until the lethality of whatever they'd caught sight of presented itself with enough clarity for somebody to think to go around back and kill the Berkeley home's power. The entertainment had popped up in New Iberia, Louisiana. Tempe, Arizona had lost two-thirds of the attendees of an avant-garde film festival in Arizona State University's Entertainment Studies Amphitheater before a level-headed custodian killed the building's whole grid. Jay Gentle had been apprised about the thing only after it had popped up and taken out a diplomatically immune Near Eastern medical attaché and a dozen incidentals here in Boston, Massachusetts, late last spring. These persons, now, all in wards. Docile and content, but blank, as if, on some deep reptile brain level, pithed. Tyne toured a ward. The person's lives, meanings, had collapsed to such a narrow focus that no other activity or connection could hold their attention. Possessed of roughly the mental, spiritual energies of a moth now, according to a diagnostician out of CDC. The Berkeley cartridge had vanished from an SFPD evidence room, an electron microscopy toss of which had revealed flannel fibers. The DEA had lost four field researchers and a consultant before they'd bowed to the intractable problems involved in trying to have somebody view the confiscated Tempe cartridge and articulate the thing's lethal charms. The strongest possible language had been necessary to restrain a certain famous crooner from attempting a personal review of the thing's qualities. Neither CDC nor the entertainment pros wanted any part of any controlled viewing tests. Three members of the Academy of DAS had received unlabeled copies in the mail, and the one who'd actually sat down to have a look now needed a receptacle under his chin at all times. Reports of the thing popping up yet again in Metro Boston, Massachusetts, remain unsubstantiated. Tyne's been dispatched here, in part, to coordinate substantiation. There's also the special pocket Franklin planner-sized chart he charts the daily AM penis measurement in, daily, though to the uninitiated, the little leather notebook could look like almost anything statistical at all. But now several USO test subjects, volunteers from the federal and military penal systems, have been lost in attempts to produce a description of the cartridge's contents. The Tempe and New Iberia cartridges are in custody, vaulted. A psychopathic and mentally retarded lance corporal at Leavenworth, strapped down with electrode appliques and headset recorder, was able to report that the thing apparently opens with an engaging and high-quality cinematic shot of a veiled woman going through a large building's revolving doors and catching a glimpse of someone else in the revolving doors, somebody the sight of whom makes her veil billow, before the subject's mental and spiritual energies abruptly declined to a point where even near-lethal voltages through the electrodes couldn't divert his attention from the entertainment. Tyne's staff had sifted through dozens of entries before deciding that the intelligence community's terse little name for the allegedly enslaving entertainment would be the Samizdat. PETs on sacrificed subjects revealed unexceptional wave activity, with not near enough alpha to indicate hypnosis or induced dopamine surges. Attempts to trace the matrix of the Samizdat without viewing it, from induction on postal codes, e-microscopies on the brown-padded mailers, immolation and chromatography on the unlabeled cartridge cases, extensive and maddening interviews of those civilians exposed. Place the likely dissemination point someplace along the U.S. North border, with routing hubs in Metro Boston, New Bedford, and or somewhere in the desert southwest. The U.S.'s Canadian problem is USOUS Anti-ONAN Activities Agency's special province, so to speak. The possibility of Canadian involvement in the lethally compelling entertainment dissemination is what has brought to Metro Boston Rodney Tyne, his retinue, and his ruler. Late p.m., Monday, the 9th of November, year of the Depend Adult Undergarment. For reasons that Pemulus couldn't for the life of him, Ortho Stice seemed to be in there in Dr. Dolores Rusk's office, interfacing with Dr. Rusk well after regular hours. Pemulus paused at the door on his way by.
Nicholas Esmond, after our work together on your fear of weights, would be that your presenting maladjustment, Ortho, like many males and athletes, is that you're suffering from counterphobia.
Fear of linoleum? There was unmistakably the flat twang of the darkness in there through the door's wood.
On the level of objects and a projective infantile omnipotence, where you experience magical thinking about your thoughts and the behavior of objects' relations to your narcissistic wishes, the counterphobia presents as the delusion of some special agency or control to compensate for some repressed, wounded inner trauma having to do with absence of control.
Over linoleum?
My suggestion might be to forget linoleum and objects in general. In, for instance, an analytic model, the types of traumas counterphobic reactions cover are almost always pre-Oedipal, at which stage objects' cathexis is Oedipal and symbolic. For example, small children's dolls and action figurines.
I don't play with no goddamn action figurines.
G.I. Joe typically being cathected as an image of the potent but antagonistic father, the military man with G.I. representing at once the general issue of a weapon, the Oedipal child both covets and fears, and a well-known medical acronym for the gastrointestinal tract, with all the attendant anal anxieties that require repression in the Oedipal phase's desire to control the bowels in order to impress or, quote, win the mother, of whom the Barbie might be seen as the most obviously reductive and phallocentric reduction of the mother to an archetype of sexual function and availability, the Barbie as image of the Oedipal mother as image.
So you're saying I'm overestimating objects?
I'm saying there's a very young ortho in there, with some very real abandonment issues, who need some nurturing and championing from the older ortho, instead of indulging in fantasies of omnipotence.
I ain't omnipotent, and I don't want to ex no goddamn Barbie doll.
The Dark's voice went way up and cracked as he said something about his bed. Dr. Rusk's office had a non-conducting, rubberized sheath on the knob, and Dr. Rusk's name and degrees and title, and a needlepoint sampler, with a little heart inside a big heart and a cursive exhortation to champion an inner child today, which the little kids at ETA find puzzling and upsetting. Pemulus, pausing by habit, first at the silent locked infirmary door, and then Rusk's bottom-cracklit door, on his way across the ComEd lobby, was wearing the most insolent ensemble he could throw together. He wore maroon paratrooper's pants with green stovepipe stripes down the sides. The pants' cuffs were tucked into fuchsia socks above ancient and radically uncool Clark's Wallabies, with dirty soles of eraserish gum. He wore an orange fake silk turtleneck under an English-cut sport coat with a purple and tan windowpane check. He wore navel shoulder braid at the level of ensign. He wore his yachting cap, but with the bill bent up at a bumpkinish angle. He looked less insolent than just extremely poorly dressed, really. Dr. Rusk's door was cool against his ear. Jim Trolch had been coming down B's hall just as Pemulus was leaving, and said Pemulus looked like a hangover. Through the door, Rusk was urging Stice to name his anger, and Stice was proposing to name his anger Horace, after his old man's late pointer that had got into some coyote bait when the darkness was nine and was much missed by the Holstice brood back in Kansas. The old Wallabies were from Pemulus's older brother's incomplete public school career, and had boogerish little greebles of dirty gum all around the soles perimeter. The socks belonged to Jenny Bash, and she made it explicit she wanted them back, laundered. The sport coat's checked arms were several centimeters too short, and exposed ribbed cuffs of shiny orange acetate esters. The community and administration buildings downstairs was real quiet. It was like 2100 hours, supposedly mandatory study period, and Artie's crew had gone home, but the custodial graveyard shift hadn't come on yet. Pemulus moved noiselessly northeast to southwest across the lobby's shag. Except for lines of lamplight from under a couple doors, the ETA lobby was pitch black, and the outer academy doors locked. There was an odd vehicular shape near the north wall's trophy case, but Pemulus didn't pause to investigate. He lifted up slightly to keep the little southwest hall's door from squeaking as he opened it, and entered the administrative reception area, snapping his fingers softly to himself. A loose music played in his head. Tavis's reception area was empty and dim, the wallpaper's clouds now stormy dark. It wasn't totally quiet. Light came from Mrs. Ink's doorway and from the crack under Tavis's inner door. Lateral Alice Moore had gone home. Pemulus activated her third rail and played with her chair as he made a very quick survey of the material on her desk. Activating the PA mic was out of all question. Two of her five drawers were still locked. Pemulus scanned behind him and popped another breath mitt, and sat quietly for a moment as Moore's chair slid back and forth along the rail, his fingers in a steeple under his nose, considering. Light shone from the crack of Tavis's inner door, because the outer door stood open. Pemulus didn't even have to put any kind of ear to the wood of the inside door. He could hear the hiss and high-speed grind of Tavis's stair blaster, and Tavis's breathless, recessive voice. You could tell there was nobody else in there. You could tell Tavis had no shirt on, and an ETA towel around his neck, and his hair a sweaty curtain down one side of his little head, as he ran to keep up with what reminded everybody of a satanishly possessed Filene's escalator. He was exhorting himself in a kind of fast rhythmic chant that sounded to Pemulus like either, "Total worry, total worry," or, "No, don't worry, no, don't worry." And see, Pemulus could envision Tavis's round belly and little titties of fat bouncing with the action of the stair blaster. You could hear the sudden muffling when he probably brought the towel up to dab at his slanted mustache. Tavis's doorknob had no insulating rubber sheath, Pemulus noticed. Pemulus's ensemble's belt was a plastic thing with chintzy, fake Navajo beading, purchased by little Chip Sweeney at one of last fall's Whataburger's souvenir stands, and subsequently transferred to Pemulus during a Big Buddy Tennis as Game of Chance exercise. The beading patterns were in Gila Monster orange and black, the orange a different shade than Pemulus's turtleneck. He could never resist biting down once a mint had melted to a certain size and texture. The doorless Dean of Academic Affairs' office was a blazing rectangle of light. The light didn't spill very far into the reception area, however. At close range, sounds issued from the office, but not exactly words. Pemulus checked his fly and snapped his fingers under his own nose, and assumed a businesslike stride and rapped firmly on the doorless jamb without breaking stride. The heavier blue shag of the office itself slowed him down a bit. He stopped once he was all the way in. 18A, John Wayne, and Hal's Mumsley Wumsley were both in the front of the office. They were about maybe 2 meters apart. The room was lit overhead, and by four standing lamps. The seminar table and chairs cast a complicated shadow. Two homemade pom-poms of shredded paper, and what looked like the amputated handles of wooden tennis rackets, were on the seminar table, which was otherwise bare. John Wayne wore a football helmet, and light shoulder pads, and a Russell athletic supporter, and socks, and shoes, and nothing else. He was down in the classic three-point stance of U.S. football. Ink's incredibly tall and well-preserved mother, Dr. Avril Incandenza, wore a little green and white cheerleader's outfit, and had one of DeLint's big brass whistles hanging around her neck. She was blowing on the whistle, which appeared to be minus the little inside pellet, because no whistling sound resulted. She was about 2 meters from Wayne, facing him, doing near splits on the heavy shag, one arm up, and pretending to blow the whistle, while Wayne produced the classic low-register growling sounds of U.S. football. Pemulus made rather a show of pushing the bumpkin-billed yachting hat back to scratch his head, blinking. Mrs. Ink was the only one looking at him. "I probably won't even waste everybody's time asking if I'm interrupting," Pemulus said. Mrs. Ink seemed frozen in place. Her one hand was still up in the air. Fine fingers splayed. Wayne craned his neck to look over at Pemulus from under his helmet, without changing his three-point stance. The football noises trailed off. Wayne's got a narrow nose and close-set witchy eyes. He wore a plastic mouthguard. The musculature of his legs and buttocks was clearly outlined as he squatted forward with his weight on his knuckles. There was way less time passing in the office than there seemed to be. "Hoping for a second of your time," Pemulus told Mrs. Ink. He was standing, schoolboy straight, hands clasped demurely over his fly, which on Pemulus, this posture did look insolent. Wayne straightened up and moved toward his clothing with no little dignity. His sweats were neatly folded on the dean's desk at the rear of the office. The mouthguard was attached to the face mask, and hung from it when removed. The chin strap had several snaps Wayne had to undo. "Nice-looking helmet," Pemulus told him. Wayne, pulling hard on his sweatpants cuff to fit them over a shoe, didn't reply. He was so fit that his supporter's straps didn't even dent his buttocks. Mrs. Incandenza removed the mute whistle. She was still split down on the floor. Pemulus made rather a show of not looking south of her face. She pursed her lips to chuff hair out of her eyes. "I predict this'll take about 2 minutes at most," Pemulus said, smiling. Wednesday, the 11th of November, year of the Depend Adult Undergarment. Lance wears a worsted topcoat and dark slacks and Brazilian loafers with a high wadded shine and a disguise that makes him look like Andy Warhol with a tan. Bruce Green wears a cheesy off-the-rack leather jacket of stiff, cheap leather that makes the jacket creak when he breathes. This is when you find out you're what true character is, when it's pointed right at you and some bug-eyed fucking spick's not 5 minutes away pointing it. And I get real calm, see? And I said, Pepito, man, you go on and do what you need to do, man. Go on and shoot, but man, better kill me with the first shot, man, or you won't get another one, I said. Not even bullshitting, man. I'm serious. It's like I found right then I meant it. You know what I'm saying? Green lights both their smokes. Lance exhales with that hiss of people in a rush to drive their point home. You know what I'm saying?
I don't know.
It's an urban November PM. Very last leaves down, dry gray hairy grass, brittle bushes, gap-toothed trees. The rising moon looks like it doesn't feel very well. The click of Lance's loafers and the crunchy thud of Green's old asphalt spreader's boots with the thick black soles. Green's little noises of attention and assent. He says he's been broken by life, is all he'll personally say, Green. Life has kicked his ass, and he's regrouping. Lance likes him, and there's always this slight hangnail of fear, like clinging whenever he likes somebody. It's like something terrible could happen at any time. Less fear than a kind of tension in the region of stomach and ass. An all-body wince, deciding to go ahead and think somebody's a stand-up guy. It's like you drop something, you give up all of your power over it, you have to stand there, impotent, waiting for it to hit the ground. All you can do is brace and wince. It kind of enrages Lance to like somebody. There would be no way to say any of this out loud to Green. As it gets past 2200 hours and the meatloaf in his pocket's baggie's gone dark and hard from disuse, the pressure to exploit the circa 2216 interval for resolution builds to a terrible pitch, But Len still can't yet quite get it up to ask Green to walk back some other way, at least once in a while. How does he do it, and still have Green know he thinks he's okay? But you don't come right out there and let somebody hear you say you think they're okay. When it's a girl you're just trying to X, it's a different thing. Straightforwarder. But like, for instance, where do you look with your eyes when you tell somebody you like them and mean what you say? You can't look right at them. Because then, what if their eyes look at you, as your eyes look at them, and you lock eyes as you're saying it, and then there'd be some awful, like, voltage or energy there hanging between you. But you can't look away like you're nervous, like some nervous kid asking for a date or something. You can't go around giving that kind of thing of yourself away. Plus, the knowing that the whole fucking thing's not worth this kind of wince and stress, the whole thing's enraging. The afternoon of tonight, earlier, at circa 16:10 hours, Lent had sprayed Rigid brand male hairspray in the face of a one-eyed Ennett House stray cat that had wandered by mischance into the men's head upstairs, but the result? Unsatisfying. The cat had just run away downstairs, clunking into the banister only once. Lent then got diarrhea, which always disgusts him, and he had to stay in the head and open the little warped, frosted glass window and run the shower on C until the smell's evidence cleared, with fucking Glenn pounding on the door and attracting attention, howling about, "Who's flailing the whale in there all this time? Is it, by any chance, Lentz?" But then how would he be supposed to act henceforward toward Green if he blows him off and says to let him walk solo home? How would he be supposed to act if it had seemed like he'd, like, spurned Green? What does he henceforward say if he and Green pass each other in the aisle at Saturday Night Lively, or both reach for the same sandwich at the raffle break at White Flag, or get caught standing there, half-naked in towels in the hall, waiting for somebody to get out of the shower? What if he, like, spurns Green, and Green ends up in the three-man room while Lentz is still in there, and they have to room together, and interface, constantly? And if Lentz tries to temper the spurning by telling Green he likes him, where the fuck is he supposed to look when he says it? If trying to X a female species, Lentz would have nulo problemo with where to look. He'd have no problem with looking deep into some bitch's eyes and looking so sincere it's like he's dying inside him. Or if, like, assuring a bad-complected Brazilian he hadn't stepped on a half kilo three separate times with inositol. Or if high, zero problem. If he got high, he'd have no problem telling somebody he liked him, even if he really did. For it'd give his spirits a voltage that'd more than overweigh whatever upsetting voltage might hang in the air between somebody. A few linskers, and there'd be no stress issues about telling Bruce G., with all due respects, to screw. Go peddle his papers. Go play in the freeway. Go play with a chainsaw. Go find a short pier. That, no disrespect, but Lentz needed to fly solo in the urban night. So after the incident with the cat and diarrhea, and some hard words with D.R. Glynn, who was slumped holding his abdomen down against the south wall of the upstairs hall, Lentz decides enough is enough, and goes and gets a little square of foil off the industrial roll Don G. keeps under the Ennett sink, and goes and takes a half gram, maybe a gram, at most, out of the emergency stash of the vault thing he's razored out of the principles of natural lectures. Far from your scenario of relapsing, the being is medicinal support for assertively sharing his need for aloneness with Green, so that issues of early sobriety can get resolved before standing in the way of spiritual growth. Lentz will use cocaine in the very interests of sobriety and growth itself. So then, like, strategically, at the Brookline Young People's Meeting over on Beacon near the Newton Line on a Wednesday, at the raffle break, at 21:09 hours, Lentz moistens his half-gasper and puts it carefully back in the pack and yawns and stretches and does a quick pulse check and gets up and saunters casually into the handicapped head with a lockable door and the big sort of crib built around the shitter itself for crippled lowering onto the toilet and does, like, maybe two, maybe three generous lines of Bing off the top of the toilet tank and wipes the tank top off, both before and after, with wet paper towels, ironically rolling up the same crisp buck he'd brought for the meeting's collection, and utilizing it and cleaning it thoroughly with his finger and rubbing his gums with the finger, and then putting his head way back in the mirror to check the kidney-shaped nostrils of his fine aquiline nose for clinging evidence in the trim hair up there, and tasting the bitter drip in the back of his frozen throat, and taking the clean rolled buck and back-rolling it and smoothing it out and hammering it with his fist on the lip of the sink and folding it neatly into half of half its original Treasury Department size, so that all evidence anybody ever even had a passing thought of rolling the buck into a hard, tight tube is, like, annihilated. Then sauntered back out, like butter wouldn't soften anywhere on his body, knowing just where to look at all times and casually hefting his balls before he sat back down. And then, aside from the every-so-often hemispasm of the mouth and right eye he hides via the old sunglasses-and-pretend-to-cough tactic, the second half of the meeting's endless oratory goes fine, he supposes, even though he did smoke almost a whole expensive pack of Gaspers in 34 minutes, and the holier-than-you young people AAs over in what were supposed to be the non-smoking rows of chairs against the east wall to his right shot him over some negative-type looks when perchance he happened to find he had one going in the little tin ashtray and two at once going in his mouth. But Lentz was able to play the whole thing off with insistent aplomb, sitting there in his aviator sunglasses with his legs crossed and his top-coated arms resting out along the backs of the empty chairs on either side. The night noises of the metro night. Harbor wind skirling on angled cement. The hush and skein of overpass traffic. TP's laughter in interior rooms. The yowl of unresolved cat life. Horns blatting off in the harbor, receding sirens, confused inland gulls' cries, broken glass from far away, car horns in gridlock, arguments in languages, more broken glass, running shoes, a woman's either laugh or scream from who can tell how far, coming off the grid, dogs defending whatever dog yards they pass by, the sounds of chains and risen hackles, the podiatric click and thud, the visible breath, gravel's crunch, creak of greens leather, the snick of a million urban lighters, the gauzy far-off humming ATH-SCMEs pointing out true plumb north, the clunk and tinkle of stuff going into dumpsters, the rustle of stuff in dumpsters settling, the skirl of wind on the sharp edges of dumpsters, and unmistakable clanks and tinkles of dumpster divers and can miners, going after dumpsters, cans, and bottles. The District Redemption Center down in West Brighton, and actually even boldly sharing a storefront with Liquor World Liquor Store, so the can miners can do, like, one stop, redeeming and shopping. Which Lentz finds repellent to the Maximus, and shares the feelings with Green. Lentz observes to Green how myriadly ironic are the devices by which the famous crooner's promise to clean up our urban cities has come to be kept. The noises parallaxing in from out over the city's winking grid at night. The woolly haze of monoxides. You got your faint cunt stink of the wind off the bay. Plain's little crucifix of landing lights well ahead of their own noise. Crows and towns. You got your standard crepuscular rustles. Ground floors lit windows laying little rugs of light out into their lawns. Porch lights that go on automatically when you stroll by. A threnody of sirens somewhere north of the Charles. Bare trees creaking in the wind. The state bird of Massachusetts, he shares with Green, is the police siren. To protect and to swerve. The cries and screams from out across, who knows how many blocks, who knows the scream's intent. Sometimes the end of the scream is at the sound of the start of the scream, he opines. The visible breath and the rainbowed rings of streetlights and headlights through that breath. Unless the screams are really laughing. Lentz's own mother's laugh, it sounded like she was being eaten alive. Except, after maybe five total lines hoovered in a totally purposive, medicinal, non-recreational spirit, except then, instead of assuring Green he's a blue-chip commodity on Lentz's exchange, but to please screw and let Lentz stroll home solo with his meatloaf and agenda, It eventuates that Lance has again miscalculated the effect the Bing's hydrolysis will have. He always, like, previsions the effect as cool, nonchalant, verbal, sang-froid. But instead, Lance, on the way home, finds himself under huge, hydralistic compulsion to have Green right there by his side. Or basically anyone who can't get away, or won't go away, right there with him. And to share with Green, or any compliant ear, pretty much every experience and thought he's ever had. To give each datum of the case of R. Lentz shape and visible breath, as his whole life and then some tear asses across his mind's arctic horizon, trailing phosphenes. He tells Green that his phobic fear of timepieces stems from his stepfather, an Amtrak train conductor with deeply unresolved issues, which he used to make Lance wind his pocket watch and polish his fob daily with a chamois cloth, and nightly make sure his watch's displayed time was correct to the second, or else he'd lay into the pint-sized Randy with a rolled-up copy of Track and Flange, a slick and wickedly heavy coffee-table-sized trade periodical. Lentz tells Green how spectacularly obese his own late mother had been, using his arms to dramatically illustrate the dimensions involved. He breathes between about every third or fourth fact, ergo, about once a block. Lentz tells Green the plots of several books he's read, confabulating them. Lentz doesn't notice the way Green's face sort of crumples blankly when Lentz mentions the issues of late mothers. Lentz euphorically tells Green how he once got the tip of his left finger cut off in a minibike chain once, and how, but within days of intensive concentration, the finger had grown back and regenerated itself like a lizard's tail, confounding doctoral authorities. Lentz says that was the incident in youth after which he got in touch with his own unusual life force, an énergie de vivre, and knew and accepted that he was somehow not like the run of common men, and began to accept his uniqueness and all that it entailed. Lentz clues Green in on it's a myth the Nile crocodile is the most dreaded species of crocodile, that the dreaded estuarial crocodile of saltwater habits is a billion times more dreaded by those in the know. Lentz theorizes that his compulsive need to know the time with microscopic precision is also a function of his stepfather's dysfunctional abuse regarding the pocket watch and track and flange. This segues into an analysis of the term dysfunction and its relevance to the distinctions between, say, psychology and natural religion. Lentz tells how once in the back bay on Boylston, outside Bonwitz, a pushy prosthesis vendor gave him a hard time about a glass eye item of jewelry and got his issues juices flowing. And then down the prosthesis vendor line, another vendor simply would not take no of any sort about a bottle of ADA-approved, zero-lube saliva substitute, with a confabulated celeb endorsement from J. Gentle F. Crooner on it, and Lentz utilized a keto to break the man's nose with one blow, and then drive the bones, shards, and fragments up into the vendor's brain with the follow-up heel of his hand, a maneuver known by a secret ancient Chinese term meaning the old one-two. Eliminating the saliva guy's map on the spot, so that Lentz had learned about the lethality of his whatever was beyond black belt in Aikido, and his hands' deadliness as weapons when his issues were provoked, and tells Green how he'd taken a solemn vow right there, running like hell down Boylston from the auditorium T-stop to evade prosecution, vowed never to use his lethally adept Aikido skills except in the most compulsory situation of defending the innocent and or weak. Lentz tells Green how once he was at a Halloween party, where a hydrocephalic woman wore a necklace made of dead gulls. Lentz shares about this recurving dream where he's seated under a tropical ceiling fan in a cane chair, wearing an L.L. Bean safari hat, and holding a wickerware valise in his lap. And that's all. And that's the recurving dream. On the 400 block of West Beacon, around 2202 hours, Lentz demonstrates for Bruce Green the secret Aikido 1-2, with which he'd demapped the saliva monger, breaking the move down into slow-mo constituent movements so that Green's untrained eye could follow. He says there's another recurving nightmare about a clock with hands frozen eternally at 18:30 that's so trouser-foulingly scary he won't even burden Green's fragile psychology with the explicits of it. Green, lighting both their smokes, says he either doesn't remember his dreams, or doesn't dream. Lentz adjusts his white toupee and mustache in a darkened interlace outlet's window, does the odd bit of Tai Chi stretching, and blows his nose into West Beacon's cluttered gutter Euro-style, one nostril at a time, arching to keep his coat front well back from what he expels. Green's one of these muscle shirt types that carries his next gasper tucked up over his ear, which the use of Rigid or other brands of quality hair fixative makes impossible, for the reason that residues of spray on the cigarette cause it to burst unexpectedly into flame at points along its length. Lance regales how, at that Halloween party with the necklace of birds, there'd been allegedly a concavity refugee infant there, at the party, at the home of a South Boston orthodontist that dealt lidocaine to Bing retailers on the prescriptional dickie. A normal size and unferal infant, but totally without a skull, lying in a kind of raised platform or dais by the fireplace, with its shapeless and de-skulled head region supported and, like, shuddering, contained in a sort of lidless plastic box, and its eyes were sunk way down in its face, which was the consistency of, like, quicksand, the face, and its nose concave and its mouth hanging out over either side of the boneless face, and the total head had, like, conformed to the inside of the containing box it was contained in, the head, and appeared roughly square in overall outline, the head. And the woman with the lay of gull heads and other persons in costumes had ingested hallucinogens and drank mezcal and ate little worms in the mezcal and had performed circled rituals around the box and platform around 2355 hours, worshipping the infant, or, as they termed it simply, the infant, as if there were only one. Green lets Lance know the time at roughly 2-minute intervals, maybe once a block, from his cheap but digital watch, when the critical BBSB liquid crystal sign is obscured by the urban night's strolling skyline. Lance's labial writhing occurs worst on diphthongs involving O sounds. Lance clues Green in that AANA works all right, but there's no fucking question it's a cult. He and Green have apparently got themselves to the point where the only way out of the addictive tailspin is to enlist in a fucking cult and let them try to brainwash your ass. And that the first person tries to lay a saffron robe or tambourine on Lance is going to be one very sorry caballero indeed, is all. Lance claims to remember some experiences which he says happened to him in vitro. Lance says the Ennett graduates who often come back and take up living room space, sitting around comparing horror stories about former religious cults they'd tried joining as part of their struggle to try to quit with the drugs and alcohol, are not without a certain naive charm, but are basically naive. Lance details that robes and mass weddings and head shaving and pamphleteering in airports and selling flowers on median strips and signing away inheritances and never sleeping and marrying whoever they tell you and then never seeing who you marry are small potatoes in terms of bizarre cult criterion. Lance tells Green he knows individuals who've heard shit that would blow Green's mind out his ear sockets. At lunchtime, Hal Incandenza was lying on his bunk in bright sunlight through the window with his hands laced over his chest. And Jim Trolch poked his head in and asked Hal what he was doing, and Hal told him photosynthesizing, and then didn't say anything else until Trolch went away. Then, 41 breaths later, Michael Pemulis stuck his head in where Trolch's had been. "Did you eat yet?" Hal made his stomach bulge up and patted it, still looking at the ceiling. "The beast is killed and gorged and now lies in the shade of the baobab tree." "Gotcha." "Surveying his loyal pride." "I gotcha." Over 200 breaths later, John N.R. Wayne opened up the ajar door a little more and put his whole head in, and stayed like that, with just his head in. He didn't say anything, and Hal didn't say anything. And they stayed like that for a while, and then Wayne's head smoothly withdrew. Under a street lamp on Faneuil Street off West Beacon, Randy Lance shares a vulnerable personal thing, and tilts his head back to show Bruce Green where his septum used to be. Randy Lance regales Bruce Green about certain real estate cults in Southern California and the West Coast, of Delawareans that still believed virtual reality pornography, even though it'd been found to cause bleeding from the eye corners and real-world permanent impotence, was still the key to Shangri-La, and believed that some sort of perfect piece of digito-holographic porn was circulating somewhere in the form of a bootleg, write-protect-notched software diskette, and devoted their cultic lives to snuffling around trying to get hold of the virtual Kama Supra diskette, and getting together in dim Wilmington-area venues and talking very obliquely about rumors of where and just what the software was and how their snufflings for it were going, and watching virtual fuck films and mopping the corner of their eyes, etc. Or of something called Stelliform Cultism that Bruce Green isn't even near ready to hear about, Lentz opines. Or like, for example, of a suicidal nook cult of nooks that worshipped a form of Russian roulette that involved jumping in front of trains and seeing which nook could come the closest to the train's front without getting demapped. What sounds like Lentz chewing gum is really Lentz trying to talk and grind his teeth together at the same time. Lentz recalls orally that his stepfather's blue-vested gut had preceded the conductor into rooms by several seconds, fob glinting above the watch pocket's sinister slit. How Lentz's mother, back in Fall River, had made it a point of utilizing Greyhound for voyages and sojourns, basically to piss her step-husband off. Lentz discusses how a serious disadvantage to dealing Bing retail is the way customers will show up pounding on your door at 0300, sporting lint in the terms of resources, and putting their arms around your shins and ankles and begging for just a half gram or tenth of a gram, and offering to give Lentz their kids, like Lentz wants to fucking deal with anybody's kids, which these scenes were always constant drags on his spirits. Green, who's hoovered his share, says cocaine always seemed like it grabbed you by the throat and just didn't let go, and he could relate to why the Boston AA's call being the express elevator to AA. In a dumpster-lined easement between Faneuil Street and Brighton Avenue, Brighton, right after Green almost steps in what he's pretty sure is human vomit, Lentz proves logically why it's all too likely that Ennett House resident Jeffrey D. is a closet poofta. Lentz reports how he's been approached in the past to male model and act, but that the male model and acting profession is pretty much crawling with your closet pooftas, and it's no kind of work for a man that's confronted the ins and outs of his own character. Lentz speculates openly on how there are purported to be whole packs and herds of feral animals operating in locust-like fashion in the rhythmic lushness of parts of the Great Concavity to the due northeast, descended, reputedly, from domestic pets, and abandoned during the relocational transition to an ONANite map, and how teams of pro-researchers and amateur explorers and intrepid hearts and cultists have entered northeast of checkpoints along the loose-sided ATHS-CM-ulated walls and never returned, vanishing in toto from the shortwave EM bands, as in, like, dropping off the radar. Green turns out to have no conceptions or views on the issues of fauna of the concavity at all. He literally says he's never given it one thought, one way or the other. Whole new England cults and stelliform subcults, Lentz reports, as existing around belief systems about the metaphysics of the concavity and annular fusion and BS 1950s B cartridge type radiation affected fauna and over fertilization and verdant forests of periodic oases of purported desert and whatever, east of the former Montpelier, Vermont area, of where the annulated Shawshine River feeds the Charles, and tints it the exact same tint of blue as the blue on boxes of hefty steel sacks, and the ideas of rivacious herds of feral, domesticated house pets and oversized insects not only taking over the abandoned homes of relocated Americans, but actually setting up house and keeping them in model repair and impressive equity, allegedly, and the idea of infants the size of prehistoric beasts roaming the over-fertilized East Concavity quadrants, leaving enormous scat piles and keening for the abortive parents who'd left or lost them, in the general geopolitical shuffle of mass migration and really fast packing, or, as some of your more Limbaugh-era-type cultists sharingly believe, originating from abortions hastily disposed of in barrels and ditches that got breached and mixed ghastly contents with other barrels that reanimated the abortive foeti and brought them to a kind of repulsive, oversized, bee-cartridge life thundering around due north of where, yours truly, and Green strolled through the urban grid. Of one local underground Stelliform offshoot from the Bob Hope-worshipping Rastafarians who smoke enormous dupesters and wove their negroid hair into clusters of wet cigars, like the Rastafarians, but instead of Rastafarians, these post-Rastas worshipped the infant, and every New Year donned tie-dyed parkas and cardboard snowshoes and ventured northward, trailing smoke, past the walls and fans of Checkpoint Pongo, into the former areas of Vermont and New Hampshire, seeking the infant, they called it, as if there were only one, and toting paraphernalia for performing a cultish ritual, referred to, in oblique tones only, as propitiating the infant. Whole posses of these Stelliform pothead reggae-swaying infant cultists disappearing forever off the human race's radar every winter, never heard or smelled again, regarded by fellow cultists as martyrs and or lambs, possibly too addled by blimp-sized dupesters to find their way back out of the concavity and freezing to death, or enswarmed by herds of feral pets, or shot by property-value-conscious insects, or, face-plum-colored, finally breathing, worse. Lance shudders just at the thought of the raging powerlessness he'd feel, he shares. Lost and disoriented, wandering in circles, in blinding white frozen points due north of all domesticated men. Forget the time, not even knowing what fucking date it was. His breath and ice beard, with just his tinder and wits and character to live by, armed just with a browning blade. Green opines that if Boston AA is a cult that, like, brainwashes you, he guesses he'd got himself to the point where his brain needed a good brisk washing, which Lance knows is not an original view, being exactly what big blockheaded Don Gately repeats about once a diem. Selected snippets from the individual resident, informal interface moments of D.W. Gately, live-in staff, and in-house drug and alcohol recovery house, Enfield, Massachusetts, on and off, from just after the Brookline Young People's AA meeting, up to about 23-29 hours, Wednesday, the 11th of November, YDAU. I don't know why all this shit about wanting to hear about the football all the time, and I'm not going to make my goddamn muscle. It's stupid. Okie dokie. It's inappropriate, since you like words like that. But this sharing and caring commitment guy, the chair, the Sudbury Half Measures of A-List Nothing Group, he had a power about him. The chair, he said he used to be a nuclear auditor for the defense industry. This man who was very quiet and broken-seeming and fatherly and strange. There was this kind of broken authority about him. I know what you mean. I can ID. That seemed fatherly somehow. The sponsor type. My sponsors like that, Joel, and White Flag. Can I ask, is your own personal daddy still alive?
I don't know.
Oh. Oh. My mother's dead. Worm farming. My own personal daddy's still sucking air, though, and that's how he puts it, still sucking air, in Kentucky. My mother's a worm farmer from way back, though. But so, what about this half-measures guy hit you so hard? Hard. Hard. Sounded out. Real funny. Don, well, it started out as that he spoke about himself like he used to be somebody else. Like a whole different person. He said he used to wear a four-piece suit, and the fourth piece was him. An Alston Group guy says it all the time, that joke. He had on a real nice, white, thick-weave cotton shirt, open at the throat, and wheat-colored pants and loafers with no socks, which I'm up here 10 years, Don, and I still can't follow this thing up here. about y'all all wearing nice shoes and then wrecking them by wearing them without socks.
Joel, you're maybe about the last person to be talking about somebody's inventory about weird ways they dress under there, maybe.
Kiss my rosy red ass, maybe.
Remind me to log how it's real positive to see you coming out of this shell of yours.
Well, I got reservations on this, Don, but Dial and Ken are telling me to come into you with this issue of what's, like, occurring out there, which Odetti says it's a staff-type issue, and had a little coffee tonight, have we, Foss? Well, Don, and like you know, and take a second. Inhale and blow out. I'm not going anywheres. Well, Don, I hate to be a cheese nibbler, much as the next man, but Jeff D. and Nell G. are out in the living room going around to all the new people, asking them to think about if their higher power is omnipotent enough to make a suitcase that's too heavy for him to lift. They're doing it to everybody that's new. And that skittery kid, Dingley, the new kid. Well, Don, he's sitting in the linen closet with his legs sticking out of the linen closet, with his eyes bugging out with, like, smoke coming out his ears, and going, like, he can, but he can't, but he can, respecting the suitcase, and Dial says, it's a matter for staff. It's a negative thing Day's doing. And her daddy says, I'm senior res, and to go to staff with it and to eat cheese.
Shit.
Dial said a case this negative and no way it's like ratting.
No, I appreciate. It ain't ratting.
Plus, I brought in this really good, like, Toll House butterscotch cookie thing Hanley made a plate of, which Odetti said it's not like kissing ass so much as commonplace decency.
Odetti's a community pillar. I gotta stay in here with the phone. Maybe you could tell Jeff and Nell to, like, waltz on in if they can take time out from torturing the new people.
I'll probably leave out the torturing part if that's okay with you, Don.
Which, by the way, here I am looking at this cookie still in your hand, notice.
Jesus, the cookie, Jesus.
Try and relax a little, kid. I gotta stay down with the phones till 2200. Try a plunger and let me know, and I can call services. I'm thinking it'd be doing a favor if staff clued in anybody new that comes in on the fact that the H faucet in the shower, that its H really stands for Holy Cow, That's Cold. Are you saying in a sideways way there's some trouble with the water temp in the head, McDade? Don, I'm saying just what I came in here to say. And, can I say, by the way, nice shirt. My dad used to bowl, too, when he still had a thumb. I don't care what the sick bastard told you, Yolanda. Getting on your knees in the AM to ask for help does not mean getting on your knees in the AM while this sick yacht stands in front of you and unzips his fly, and you ask for help into his fly. I'm praying this is not a male resident said this. This is the sort of thing why same-sex sponsors are only a suggestion. Is that there's some sick bastards around the rooms, you get me? Any AA tells a new female in the program to use his unit for her higher power, I'd give that guy a wide detour. You get what I'm saying?
And I didn't even tell you yet how he suggested I should thank his higher power at night.
I'd cross a broad street to avoid an AA like this guy, Yolanda.
And how he said how I always had to be on the south side of him, like stay on his south side, and have to buy a digital watch.
Holy Christ, this is Lentz. Is this Lentz you're telling me about?
I ain't used no names in here. All I say, he seemed real friendly and fly at first, and helpful, when I first came. This dude I ain't say no name.
You have trouble with the part of the second step that's about insanity, and you've been using Randy Lentz for a sponsor?
This is anonymous program, you know what I'm saying?
Jesus, kid. Orin O. in Cadenza stands embracing a putatively Swiss hen model in a rented room. They embrace. Their faces become sexual faces. It seems clear evidence of a kind of benign fate or world spirit that this incredible specimen had appeared at Sky Harbor International Airport, just as Orin stood with his fine forehead against the glass of the gate, overlooking the tarmac, after actually volunteering to drive Helen Steeply all the nightmarish way down I-17, I-10, to the ghastly, glittering, unnavigable airport, and the subject seemed, in the car, not only not especially grateful, and hadn't let him so much as place a friendly and supportive palm on her incredible quadricep during the ride,
but had been irritatingly all business, and had continued to pursue lines of family linen inquiry he'd all but begged her to quit subjecting him to the inappropriateness of. That, as he stood there after having received little other than a cool smile and a promise to try to say hello to Hallie, with his forehead against the glass of the western back door, or rather the Delta gate window, this incredible specimen had, unbidden, unstrategized, come up to him and started a lush, foreign-accented conversation, and revealed professionally loving hands as she rooted in her tripolymer bag to ask him to autograph for her toddler-age son a Cardinal souvenir football she had right there, in her bag, along with her Swiss passport. As if the universe were reaching out a hand to pluck him from the rim of the abyss of despair, that any real sort of rejection or frustration of his need for some subject he'd picked out always threatened him with. As if he'd been teetering, with his arms windmilling, at a great height without even idiotic red wings strapped to his back, and the universe were sending this lovely, steadying left hand to pull him gently back and embrace him, and not so much console him as remind him of who and what he was about, standing there, embracing a subject with a sexual face for his sexual face, no longer speaking, the football and pen on the neatly made bed, the two of them embracing between the bed and the mirror, with the woman facing the bed so that Oren could see past her head the large hanging mirror and the small framed photos of her Swiss family arrayed along the wood-grained dresser below the window. The tubby-faced man and Swiss-looking kids all smiling, trustingly, into a nothing, somewhere up and to their right. They have shifted into sexual mode. Their lids flutter, his clothes. There's a concentrated tactile languor. She is left-handed. It is not about consolation. They start the thing with each other's buttons. It is not about conquest or forced capture. It is not about glands or instincts or the split-second shiver and clench of leaving yourself, nor about love or about whose love you deep down desire, by whom you feel betrayed. Not and never love, which kills what needs it. It feels to the punter rather to be about hope, an immense, wide as the sky hope of finding a something in each subject's fluttering face, a something the same that will propitiate hope, somehow, pay its tribute. The need to be assured that for a moment he has her, now has won her, as if from someone or something else, something other than he, but that he has her, and is what she sees, and all she sees. That it is not conquest, but surrender. That he is both offense and defense, and she neither. Nothing but this 1 second's love of her, spinning as it arcs his way. Not his, but her love. That he has it, this love, his shirt off now in the mirror. That for 1 second she loves him too much to stand it. That she must, she feels, have him. Must take him inside or else dissolve into worse than nothing. That all else is gone. That her sense of humor is gone. Her petty griefs, triumphs, memories, hands, career, betrayals, the deaths of pets. That there is now inside her a vividness vacuumed of all but his name. Oh. Oh. That he is the one. This is why, maybe, one subject is never enough. Why hand after hand must descend to pull him back from the endless fall. For were there for him just one now, special and only, the one would not be he or she, but what was between them, the obliterating trinity of you and I into we. Oren felt that once, and has never recovered, and never will again. And about contempt. It is about a kind of hatred, too, along with the hope and need. Because he needs them, needs her. Because he needs her, he fears her, and so hates her a little, hates all of them. A hatred that comes out disguised as a contempt he disguises in the tender attention with which he does the thing with her buttons, touches the blouse as if it too were part of her and him, as if it could feel. They have stripped each other neatly. Her mouth is glued to his mouth. She is his breath. His eyes shut against the sight of hers. They are stripped in the mirror, and she, in a kind of virtuoso jitterbug that is 100% new world, uses O's uneven shoulders to support a leap and circle his neck with her legs. And she arches her back and is supported, her weight, by just one hand at the small of her back, as he bears her to bed, as would a waiter a tray.
Humph! Humph! Well, in excess of 1,000 pardons for my collision.
Arslanian? Is that you?
It is I, Idris Arslanian. Who is this other?
It's Ted Shock, Ed. Why the blindfold?
Where have I come, please? I became disoriented upon a set of stairs. I became panicked. I nearly removed my blindfold. Where are we? I detect many odors.
You're just off the weight room, in the little hall off the tunnel that isn't the little hall that goes to the sauna. Why the blindfold, though?
And the origin of this sound of hysterical weeping and moans? This is...
It's Anton Duchette in there. He's in there, clinically depressed. Lyle's trying to buck him up. Some of the crueler guys are in there watching like it's entertainment. I got disgusted. Somebody in pain isn't entertainment. I did my sets, now I'm in vapor trail.
You exude vapor?
Always nice to run into you, Id.
Oh, wait. Please conduct me upstairs, or into the locker for a lavatory visit. The blindfold I am wearing is experimental on the part of Thorpe. You are told of the visually challenged player who will matriculate?
The blind kid? From, like, Nowheresburg, Iowa? Dempster?
Dimfna.
He's not coming in till next term. He delayed, Ink said they said. Dural edema or something.
Though age only 9, he is in his Midwest region's ranking of 12 and below is highly ranked. Hooch Thorpe tells this.
Well, I'd say for a blind, self-skulled kid, he's real high-ranked, Ed, yeah.
But Dimfna, I hear Thorpe tell that the highness of the ranking may be due to the blindness itself. Thorpe and Tex Watson were who scouted this player.
I wouldn't mention the name Watson near that weight room in there if I were you.
Thorpe tells that his excellence of play is scouted by them to be his anticipation. As in, the player Dimfna arrives at the necessary location well before the opponent player's ball, through anticipation.
I know what anticipation is, Ed.
Thorpe tells me that this excellence in anticipation in the blind is because of hearing and sounds. Because sounds are merely... here. Please read the comment I have carefully notated upon this folded piece of paper.
Sound merely variations in intensity. Thorpe.
Thorpe? It was meaning Thorpe in excitement. He tells that one may perforce judge the opponent player's vaps in more detail by the ear than the eye. This is experimental theory of Thorpe. This is explaining why the highly ranked Dimfna appears to always have floated by magic to the necessary spot where a ball is soon to land. Thorpe tells this in a convincing manner.
Perforce?
That this blind person is able to judge the necessary spot of landing by the intensity of the sound of the ball against the opponent player's string.
Instead of watching the contact and then imaginatively extending the beginning of its flight, like those of us hobbled by sight.
I, Idris Arslanian, am compelled with Thorpe's telling.
Which helps explain the blindfold.
I therefore experiment with volunteer blindness, training the ear in degrees of intensity and play. Today, versus Whale, I was wearing the blindfold to play.
How'd it go?
Not as well as hoped. I frequently faced the wrong direction for play. I frequently judged by the intensity of balls struck on adjacent courts, and ran onto adjacent courts, intruding on play.
We sort of wondered what all the ruckus was down there, the 14's end.
Thorpe tells that training the ear is a process of time, in encouragement.
Well, later, Ed.
Stop! Wait, before leaving, please conduct me to a lavatory.
Ted Shocked?
Are you as yet there? Are you as yet there?
Watch where you're going, kid, for Christ's sake. Who is this, please?
Trolch. James L., slightly doubled over.
It is I, Idris Arslanian, wearing a rayon handkerchief as a blindfold over my features. I am disoriented and wishing badly for a lavatory. Wondering also what is ensuing inside the weight room, where Shocked alleges you are all watching Duchette weep in clinical depression.
Gertwang! Just kidding, Ars. It's really Mike Pamulus.
Then you, Mike Pamulus, may even now be questioning why is this blindfold upon Idris Arslanian.
What blindfold? Ars, no, you're wearing a fucking blindfold too?
You, Mike Pamulus, are also wearing a blindfold?
Just skirtwanging on you, brother.
I became disoriented on a stairway, then conversed with Ted Shocked. I am suspecting I do not trust your sense of laughter enough to conduct me back upstairs.
You should feel your way in and just for 1 second see the amount of high-stress sweat Lyle's taken off Anton the Booger Duchette in their Ars.
Duchette is the two-handed player whose mole appears to be material from a nostril, clinically depressing Duchette at its appearance.
Raj on the mole, except that's not what's depressing the booger this time. This one, we decided, we'd describe him as more like anxiously depressed than depressed.
One can be depressed of different types.
Boy, are you young, Ars. The booger's got himself convinced he's going to get the academic boot. He's been on probie this whole year, since apparently some trouble last year with Thorpe's cubular trick.
I am sympathizing with this in toto.
Except now he claims he's close to flunking in Watson's laughable energy survey class, which would obviously mean the old boot at term's end, if he really does flunk. He's thought himself into a brain lock of anxiety. He's in there clutching his skull with Lyle and Mario, and some of the, like, less kind guys in there having a pool going on whether Lyle can pull him back from the brink.
Texas Watson, the pro-rector, teaching of energy in models of resource scarcity and resource plenty.
Ars, I'm nodding in confirmation. Fossil fuels all the way up to annular fusion-fission cycles, DT lithiumization, so on and so forth. All on a real superficial-type level, since Watson's basically got, like, a little liquid-filled nubbin at the top of his spine where his brain ought to be.
Texas Watson does not overwhelm with brightness, it is true.
But Duchette's got himself convinced he's got this insurmagular conceptual block that keeps him from grasping annulation, even superficially.
After we converse, will you conduct me to Micturate, please?
It's the same sort of block some people get with the mean-value theorem. Or in optics, when we get to color fields. At a certain level of abstraction, it's like the brain recoils.
Causing pain of impact within the skull, resulting in clutching the head.
Watson's gone the extra click with him. Watson's good-hearted, if nothing else. He's tried flashcards, demonic rhymes, even claymation film strips from over at Rin's Latin Remedial.
You are saying without avail.
I'm saying apparently the bookster just sits there in class, eyes bugging out, stomach in fucking knots, dope slapped by anxiety. I'm saying frozen.
You are saying recoiling.
The right side of his face frozen in this anxiety tick, envisioning any possible tennis career as with these little wings on it, flying off. Talking all kinds of crazy self-injuring, anxious depression talk. It all started with him and Mario and me in the sauna, him breaking down. Me and Mario trying to talk him out of the crazy washed-up-at-15-type depressed talk. Mario exploiting a previous, like, therapeutic bond with the kid from about the mole. Then with me putting DT annulation in broad-stroke terms, a freaking invertebrate could have understood, for Christ's sake. Just about passing out from the sauna all through this. Finally taking him into Lyle, even with the 18 still doing circuits in there. Lyle's working with the booger now. Between the anxiety and the marathon sauna time, it's a real feeding frenzy for old Lyle, let me tell you.
I do confess experiences of anxiety for annulation with Tex Watson. Though I am trivially 13 and not yet required to grapple in hard science.
Mario in the sauna kept telling Duchette to just imagine somebody doing somersaults with one hand nailed to the ground, which, what the fuck is that? And lo and surprise, didn't help the booger a whole lot.
Did not part the veil of Maya.
Didn't do jack.
Annular energy circles are intensively abstract, my home nation believes.
But my whole message to Boog was that DT cycles aren't all that fucking hard if you don't paralyze your brain with Career with Wings brain cartoons. The extra-hot breedering and lithiumization stuff gets hairy, but the whole fusion-fission waste annihilation thing in toto, you can't imagine as nothing but a huge right triangle.
You are presaging to give the thumbnail lecture.
Commit this one simple model to your little Pakistani RAM cells, and you'll tap-dance right through Watson's kitty physics and up into optics, which is where the abstracto-conceptual fur really flies, kid, let me tell you.
I am one of the seldom of my home nation whose talents are weak in science, unhappily.
This is why God also gave you quick hands and a wicked lob off the backhand, though. Just picture a kind of massive, pseudo-cartographic right triangle. You got your central, impregnantly guarded ONAN, Sunstrand, waste-intensive, fusion facility up in what used to be Montpelier, in what used to be Vermont in the concavity. From Montpelier, the process's wastes piped to two sites, one of which is that blue glow up at night by the Methuen fan complex, just south of the concavity, right flush up against the wall, and checkpoint Pongo, which Arctol and sleep-depriving fans in our area point at to blow away from the south. Roger that. Where the Toxo fusion's wastes plutonium fluorides refined into plutonium-239 and uranium-238, and fissioned in a standard, if somewhat hot and risky, breeder system. Much of the output of which is waste-239, which gets piped, or catapulted, or long shiny trucked, way up to what used to be Loring AFB. Air Force Base, near what used to be Presque Isle, Maine, where it's allowed to decay naturally into neptunium-239, and then plutonium-239, and then added to the UF-sub-4 fractional waste, also piped up from Montpelier, then fissioned in a purposely ugly way, in such a way as to create, like, hellacious amounts of highly poisonous radioactive wastes, which are mixed with heavy water and specially heated zirconium, piped through specially heavily guarded heated zirconium pipes back down to Montpelier as raw material for the massive poisons needed for toxic lithiumization and waste intenseness and annular fusion.
This audiobook has been broken into multiple parts to make the download faster. You have reached the end of a part, but not the end of the complete audiobook. So please check your library for the next part of this audiobook.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.